This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, I'm delighted to have back in the studio with me Louise Knight, author of a new biography on Jane Addams called Jane Addams, Spirit in Action. Louise Knight, welcome back to Progressive Radio.
Thank you so much.
This is your second biography on Jane Addams. Why'd you go back to the plate?
Well, it surprised me that I did. The first book was about her formative years up through age 40. And I thought, well, that's what I wanted to write about. But then I began to realize that the 150th anniversary of her birth was last September. And about 2 years before that, I said, or maybe it was two and a half, I said, what am I doing? Because I knew that publishers, if they ever were going to be interested in a book about her, it would be then. And I also suddenly realized that there hadn't been a full life biography of her in 37 years. And so I thought, I've got to do something, you know, short, compact, that really captures who she was, and reintroduces people to her and brings her to younger generations.
You know, I'm surprised sometimes when I run across people younger than I am, and I'm 50. Two, who don't really even recognize Jane Addams' name anymore. Does that shock you?
Well, it doesn't shock me anymore, but I think it should be shocking. I mean, I think that Addams was the kind of person who should be as famous as Eleanor Roosevelt and as famous as Helen Keller. And Helen Keller did a whole lot, but Jane Addams did least as much, if not more.
Well, and similar to Helen Keller, I mean, to the extent that people know about Helen Keller, they know her as someone who overcame her disability.
Exactly.
They don't know her as a socialist and as a pacifist.
Yeah, she was a tremendous activist, that's right. But exactly. And I do think that one reason Addams is not better known is because she was challenging gender rules. And she was challenging them then, and she still is challenging them. And it doesn't fit the cultural stereotypes. So history books want to put her in a box and think of her as the saintly lady who cared for the poor.
And that's not totally who she was. I mean, I know they called her Saint Jane, and you have that in this book, Louise Knight, but she was so much more than that. And she didn't want to just be kind of condescending or noblesse oblige, even in that Hull House situation. So that's a misconception in itself, to the extent that people even focus on those Hull House days. In what ways did she challenge gender roles?
Well, the first thing she did was found an institution, which was not something that women usually did in 1889, other than sometimes a school or a hospital. But she founded one of the nation's early nonprofits. So that was a breakthrough. And she ran it. And there were men who lived there, too. And she was the person in charge of where they lived. So that was kind of interesting. She had the first co-ed settlement house in the world. But in addition to that, she stepped into roles both first in Chicago and Illinois and later nationally that were roles that were for men. So, and she did it without blinking. She didn't try and explain it or justify it. She just did it. So she advised presidents. She lobbied Congress. There were other women lobbying Congress, it's true. But she was very much a public figure. She lectured the nation, traveling all over the world as well. So she was a major public figure at a time when most women who were famous were actresses or philanthropists.
And she never got married. She had this lifelong relationship with Mary Rosette Smith and for decades. And that was frowned upon at some points, you say, later on in life. Was that a problem for her, that people were asking questions about this relationship? And you say it's impossible to tell exactly whether it was a sexual relationship or not, but truly they were lifelong companions.
Yes, they were definitely life partners. And when they first came together in the 1890s, there was a cultural comfort with single women living together. They didn't actually live together in the sense that Adam's home was Hull House and Mary's was in her family home, but they spend large amounts of times together visiting each other. And but that was considered, you know, fine. It was called a Boston marriage, and no one batted an eyelash. It was only after Freud became obsessed with sex and various studies were done declaring homosexuality an illness and all of that, that it started to make single-sex partnerships look strange when it came to women. And I never came across any criticism of Adams for that, but then she didn't have a household that clearly targeted her in that situation. So, but I do know that other same-sex partners were criticized in the 1930s because the times had changed.
She did get a lot of criticism for her political views, though, and she was hounded in the press because of her pacifism during World War I. She was also against the Spanish-American War in 1898. How did she come upon those views?
That's a complicated story, and it took me quite a while to sort it all out. I mean, the beginning is that she read Tolstoy's pacifism writings and Christian writings, including his pacifism, and she was converted before she moved to Hull House in the 1880s to non-resistance. But to her, that meant never be angry, never oppose in your personal relations or your political relations. She really wasn't thinking about war at that time, and there had been no war of consequence between the end of the Civil War, and she was four when that ended, till the Spanish-American War broke out. And when that broke out, she thought to herself and wrote to her friend Mary, you know, I'm going to have to become more of a Tolstoyan or less of one right off. And she was quite depressed because she knew that her integrity was being challenged by this war. And that was when she realized that she was actually opposed to war. And from then on, she became active in the peace movement. And in the early 20th century, the peace movement was actually the most non-threatening status quo popular movement you can imagine. So the president of the United States would be honorary chairman of the peace conferences that were held. And, you know, it was secretaries of war would sign up for the peace congresses to give talks, and they even would get Nobel Prizes for their interest in peace, because what they meant was they were working on legal structures that would improve mediation of disputes between nations. But then World War I broke out and the entire male status quo peace movement collapsed. And there was left standing a few people like Adams, whose belief in peace went to the core of her being and had to do with all forms of violence. So she opposed the war, even though when the United States entered, she was greatly vilified for it.
She and Eugene V. Debs and Fighting Bob La Follette and a lot of socialists and left-wing progressives at the time were vilified. La Follette was almost kicked out of the U.S. Senate. Debs was put in prison. Negative consequences did she face?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. She didn't get put into prison. She didn't say quite the most confrontational things that some of those men did. So you could say she was being careful, but then if you looked at the history of all her public speaking, you could see she never was confrontational. It wasn't her style. She did say that pacifists were patriots too, which in 1917 was a pretty radical thing to say, but they did not arrest her. What happened to her was that she lost all of her popularity. She lost her audiences. She lost her readers. The editors of the magazines wouldn't publish her work. And this actually affected her income, because this was how she supported herself, was through her writing and speaking.
And some philanthropists withdrew money you write in this book.
Yes, from Hull House. That's right. So she stood her ground in the sense that she suffered a lot of hatred and a lot of financial loss and a loss of her public voice, and she didn't back down. But she also suffered psychologically, because she drew a lot of strength from feeling connected to the people, to fellow citizens, and she knew she wasn't during the war, and that was very painful for her. She was quite depressed.
I'm speaking with Louise Knight, who is this biographer of Jane Addams, has two books out now on Jane Addams. The second one is Spirit in Action. And it's just delightful to learn more about Jane Addams in her well-roundedness in all these political issues. You talk about this opposing war. She also had an idea about anti-militarism that wasn't narrowly defined, but that was really broadly defined. Why don't you talk about that?
Yeah, this was such an interesting thing that I had not realized till I wrote this book. But Adams wrote a book called Newer Ideals of Peace in 1907, which you think might be a book about war and peace, but is actually pretty much nearly completely about domestic issues. And in it, she develops her concept of militarism, which she defines as hierarchical values and hierarchical social structures. So that, of course, includes the military, which is the world's most hierarchical institution, but also includes everything else that oppresses people who don't have a lot of power. So she was thinking about the way municipal governments treat immigrants. She said they treated them like they were the, you know, invading enemy, and is how governments and men treated women because they saw themselves as superior to women. And this was all militarism to her. So I thought that was quite an insightful breakthrough on her part. It's not exactly been picked up by anybody. But now that I understand this idea, I look around in the discussions of militarism and I think, gosh, it's a little too narrowly defined. Because really, hierarchical thinking is the way that one group of people tries to control of another group of people. That's how they rationalize their control over them. And that's how those who are controlled feel as if they should be controlled because they've bought into the hierarchy. It applies to, you know, all categories of hierarchy. So I think militarism could be used for that.
Did she have run-ins with Teddy Roosevelt? You said she consulted with or advised lots of presidents. I mean, Teddy Roosevelt was a progressive as she was, but he was of the imperialist stripe, unlike Jane Addams. What was their relationship like?
Yeah, of course, when he was president, he was semi-supportive of some progressive reform legislation. He started off saying he was in favor of a federal child labor law, which was a big breakthrough. They were all excited. But then he backed down and said, no, states' rights, we have to let each state figure it out. So that was a disappointment. He also really wasn't interested in fixing the immigration law, although Adams lobbied him to not do what he did with that. He supported a law that would allow literacy tests for immigrants entering the country. And so they were collaborators in the sense that he was interested in women and children. He helped convene a conference at the White House on women and children that was very supportive of progressive views. But once he got out of office and then became the leader of the Progressive Party in 1912, his platform was a mixed one from Adams's point of view. So he managed to support suffrage. He said because Adams persuaded him. I'm not actually persuaded that she was the reason. I think he was pretending. He wanted to link himself up to her popularity on that issue. But he was rather just trying to align himself with progressives who supported suffrage, hoping for their votes.
And he had her come to his convention where he was nominated, and she spoke there.
Yeah, and to my surprise, I found out that that was sort of a last-minute plan. That was a decision. She got invited to be a delegate to the conference just a few weeks before it happened. It was in Chicago. And then I suppose that was when, soon after, they decided to have her speak. So she seconded the nomination, which she did very briefly and succinctly by endorsing the platform and saying that, you know, Roosevelt had the right kind of courage to implement the platform, which was not exactly the biggest endorsement, but it worked.
And she had a little demonstration for suffrage on her way down, too, from the podium, didn't she?
Yeah, there was a big parade in the convention floor, and all the women clapped and carried the suffrage banner around, and she was at the front of the parade. So that was kind of a neat moment for her, a very moving one. But after World War I broke out, of course, Roosevelt, as you say, was not only imperialist, but also a militarist, and he had been lobbying forever to get more Navy ships that could be battleships, etc. So he was on one side and Adams was on the other to the build-up to the war. And so there were some harsh words passed between, well, he said some harsh words. Adams didn't return the favor, but he hated her pacifism and said so.
In his typical way, no doubt.
In his typical way, very straightforwardly and with lots of passion.
Louise Knight, after the war ended, after World War I, Adams was instrumental in forming the first head of the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. Its predecessor was called the Women's Peace Campaign, the Women's Peace Party.
Well, actually, the Women's Peace Party was the organization in the United States that organized in 1915 in January to have create a peace and women's rights platform in the United States. But then overseas, the suffragists and the pacifist women in Europe in the midst of the war wanted to do the same thing. So they invited a delegation from the Women's Peace Party to come over, and there was an international gathering and an embrace of an international platform that was very similar to the Women's Peace Platform. And the women basically were saying there must be a way to negotiate peace. You don't have to go to war. And then they had a number of other things they endorsed, like a League of Nations and like a national vote on whether any nation would go to war. And all sorts of good ideas, many of which were ended up in Woodrow Wilson's 14 points.
And did she endorse those 14 points in the Versailles Treaty? And all
yeah,
that?
She was not at all happy with the Versailles Treaty, nor was the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, because it was a very punitive treaty. She did endorse the 14 points. Of course, most of those did not make it into the treaty. But many of those points were actually based, as I said, on the Wilf platform. So she was disappointed, however, that the League of Nations went on without the United States. She thought, even though it was an imperfect solution, it was better than nothing. And she always believed that, you know, if you bring people together and have a conversation, you can do more good than if you keep people apart. And the League was a convening of leaders of nations. So she thought, well, it's worth a try. We can always improve it later.
And there was a split in the progressive movement on that. I know Fighting Bob LaFalle was opposed to the League of Nations, which I was surprised to find out when I went through some of those old issues of the Progressive. You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive. My guest today, Louise Knight, author of a new biography, Jane Addams, Spirit and Action. It was her work with the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom and her lifelong dedication to pacifism that ultimately won her the Nobel Peace Prize. Tell me how she reacted to getting the prize, and did she give an address, and if so, what did she say?
Well, she got a telegram from the Nobel Committee when she was in the hospital in Baltimore, where she was there because she needed surgery on, I forget what it was, her kidney or something, and they had a special kind of anesthesia that was good for people who had weak hearts. So she traveled from Chicago to Baltimore. So there she was, and she got the telegram, and she was told to keep it a secret from everyone except her immediate family. So she told Mary and her nephew, and that was it. But Mary wrote about Jane's reaction, and she, you know, they were all very understated, dignified women, so they didn't, like, jump up and down. But Mary could tell that it was very good news, especially the day before Addams went into surgery. Addams never left any record of her reaction to getting it. She received the Nobel money. She shared the prize with another gentleman. And so she divided that money between the Wilf board and then a capital gift to help them manage their buildings, because she had 13 buildings she wanted headed to raise money for, so she knew the burden of that. She did not go to Stockholm to give a speech, because the speech was to be the following summer. In those days, they announced it in December, and you went over the following summer because you had to go by boat. And she was ill, and so she had to cancel her plans to go. Another person made a speech on her behalf, but it was not her speech.
I wondered about that because I couldn't find any reference to it, and I thought I had skipped over something. But
no, and I actually, it's something I wish I had explicitly stated, because I should have.
No, it's quite all right. One of the organizations that she was a member of the board of, and God, she was a member of so many boards, you said the most controversial one was the NAACP.
Yeah, well, of course, the NAACP was founded in 1909, and as most people now know, that was a time of intense racism in this country, as was the case until fairly recently. So just the idea that African Americans and white Americans would form an organization together that would address issues of racism and use legal means to do it, which is a fairly aggressive thing to do, to use the law to correct injustice, was controversial. Adams was very proud of the NAACP and stayed on its board until her death. and worked with W.E.B. Du Bois and wrote articles for The Crisis, and you know, was definitely understood the horrible damage that racism had done to the United States.
It was interesting. You say she Ida Wells in Chicago opened her eyes to the problem of lynching, and asked her to give a speech at a church, I believe, where Ida Wells herself was denouncing the practice of lynching. Adams gave a speech. It wasn't her greatest speech. You want to talk about that?
Yeah, this was really interesting. Of course, you know, we read it now with from what you might say is a more enlightened viewpoint than any white, few white Americans had at that time. So what Adams did was she wrote about how it was important to respect the law. So she focused on the fact that lynching was breaking the law. It was, instead of, you know, a person who'd been arrested going through the court process, you know, the mob would take them out of the jail and hang them. Well, that was, you know, to African Americans, you know, the breaking of the law was only secondary to the fact that all the charges were trumped up in the first place. And that most of the time when the African American who was arrested was being charged often with raping a white woman, it was totally not true. And there were many other charges that were equally racist. So Adams failed to emphasize that. She noted in passing that, you know, it was probably the case that some of those charges were unjustified, but she put the emphasis on the law breaking. Now, when I read more about the context of the times, I came to understand that there was, you know, that was sort of the way in for a lot of white Americans to take an interest in lynching. And the president had spoken about it. And it was sort of the general white conversation. And Adams was sort of relating to that.
The wonderful thing about Jane Addams, as I've read this book and your previous biography on Jane Addams, Louise Knight, is that, you know, she would start from a position, a class position. And she would sometimes unwittingly reproduce the ideas of that class. But the interesting thing, the fascinating, phenomenal thing about her was that she would let herself learn. She'd let herself be brought along and taught about the falsehoods that emanated from that position. And we see that in this whole question about lynching. We saw it in her abandoning the idea of benevolence and kind of noblesse oblige toward the poor people at Hull House, and you saw it on issues of War and Peace too. What about her character allowed her to develop like that, evolve like that?
Yeah, I love your question, and it's the thing I like about Adams the most too. It's what makes me so fascinated with her to this day, because I think all of us aspire to grow. We all believe we should be attending to our own ideas and fixing them if they're not ideas that fit the truth. But Adams was a master of that. And I think what I find so inspiring about her is just what you said, that she grows and learns. Now, the other thing I can say is that she was very self-conscious about that process. This didn't happen by accident. It happened because she believed that this is how a person should be. And so you can see her writing about it in her own works, and you can see her doing it in her own life. And that's the other aspect of her that interests me, because all of us can think about self-development and think about examining our beliefs. But if you don't believe in your own integrity, and if you aren't like a watchdog on the ramparts monitoring whether you are maintaining your integrity, you will not have integrity. Integrity is a ton of work. It takes a lot of self-reflection, a lot of interpretation. And that's what Adams worked at, because she believed in it. And I think that's an idea we've sort of lost.
It's interesting, because it comes out in that line you used earlier, that quoting from Adams, "I got to be more like Tolstoy or less like Tolstoy right now."
Exactly.
She couldn't reconcile her beliefs with her positions, and she had to do some reconciling there. Similarly, she had to reconcile her beliefs in the goodwill of the capitalist class, because her dad was a capitalist, and she admired her dad, right? She revered her dad, and yet when she, in Chicago during the Pullman strike, saw capitalists acting in a more traditional, almost comic book way, she had to start changing her views there too.
Yeah, and what's so interesting is that she didn't just say, oh, well, George Pullman is the bad apple, as people like to say. She actually said, there's something going on here in his ethical system, which was my father's, and that's the ethic of benevolence, the feeling that you're superior, you know best for others what they need, which is his rationale for not talking to the striking workers. She actually questioned the ethic of benevolence. You know, she didn't try and find the easy way out. She actually went to the heart of the matter, which was exactly where she encountered the fact that she was having to reject her father's beliefs. Now, she said it more gently in her speech about the strike. She said she was adding new beliefs that were fitting for a new generation. But in fact, she was rejecting benevolence.
I thought she'd be a person who enjoyed conflict more. and yet, from the time she was young and growing up, and there were some issues there in the family with her stepmom, I guess, with conflict. She, despite her brave positions that were totally juxtaposed to the prevailing ideas at the time, she wasn't someone who would just kind of club people over the head.
Right, and that was actually part of her idea of non-resistance. And again, this was a matter of her beliefs. People think, oh, she was just a gentle soul. And she certainly wasn't a naturally confrontational person. But she was feisty, she was spirited, and she was trying to enact non-resistance, so she wasn't confrontational. But I have found, scattered about her writings, few random comments that show what I might describe as the true self. You know, you can see that inside there is this very feisty person who calls a spade, and who is really impatient with the hypocrisy that she sees.
Yeah, that was the person I was meaning to find or expecting to find, but I suppose she suppressed that more often.
Well, she packaged it, I think, yes. But her actions communicate it.
Absolutely. Now, yes. We just have a couple minutes left. Jane Addams, you know, if she were here today, you know, what would she say about America?
Well, of course, we have, many are saying we have a new Gilded Age, and I think that we do. And that was the condition that and the power of corruption that led the corruption of the government that grew out of that Gilded Age, which we also have, is what produced the progressive era, first in the states and then at the national level. So I think she would be, of course, sad that we seem to have gone backwards and a lot of progressive laws have been undone. The laws protecting unions have been undone. The progressive tax charts have been taken apart by loopholes. You know, so we have the same work to do over again. I think she would be encouraged by what she sees happening in Wisconsin, for example, but also around the country. There's a lot of progressive energy that's getting more and more organized. So I think that she would be, she's always hopeful. I think she would probably sigh that seem to be in a cyclical pattern, but she would say, let's go do something about this. Change doesn't happen unless we work at it.
Yeah, because I was thinking about things in Wisconsin with the Republican governor. We have this great fight back, which is so inspiring to those of us who are here, even though we may be losing battles here and there. But, you know, the governor here is making child labor. He's changing the rules on child labor, which is one of the basic issues that she fought for first.
I didn't know that.
They're letting young people work more and more hours, 40-hour weeks and things. So it is a turning back of the clocks here. And then nationally, you know, you see the scapegoating of immigrants that she fought against, and the civil liberties encroachments. And we have a president who did get the Nobel Prize and is engaged in 3, 4, 5 wars, depending on how you count.
Yeah.
So I'm sure that Jane Addams would have plenty to say about America here in the year 2011. And so I'd recommend to anyone who doesn't know Jane Addams in her full dimensions to pick up a copy of this book. It's called Jane Addams, Spirit in Action. It's by Louise Knight. It's her second biography on Jane Addams. Both are tremendous and bring back to us. We need to reclaim these great people in our progressive past. Jane Addams is certainly one of the towering figures of the progressive movement. Louise Knight, thanks so much for being my guest again.
Thank you so much.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.